national group that works to register Hispanic voters is launching a cell phone app and a provocative campaign.
We're launching a campaign called F the Wall, and that stands for Fight the Wall, Register a Mexican to Vote.
I'm Shelley Koffler, and we'll tell you more about that in this half hour of Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. The national group is the Southwest Voter Registration Project. Its president, Antonio Gonzalez, believes there will be a surge in registration this presidential year because of anti-Hispanic activity. The app is designed to jumpstart the campaign and reach a growing number of Hispanic millennials. Antonio Gonzalez says anti-immigration efforts have spurred voter registration in the past. He points to California Governor Pete Wilson's support of a 1994 state ballot proposition to prohibit undocumented immigrants from receiving social services. And in Maricopa County, Arizona, Sheriff Joe Arpaio ordered deputies to stop Hispanic drivers because they might be in the country illegally. Gonzalez says both efforts resulted in a flood of new Hispanic voters.
We've been able to look at those elections in which anti-immigrant ballot measures and state legislation were key elements in the politics of those states, and look at the Latino response. And what we've seen is tremendous expansion of Latino registration and voting. For example, the Latino vote in California doubled in the 1990s, largely as a response to the perception of anti-Latino policies. The Latino vote in Arizona has tripled between 2002 and 2014. We used to call it the Pete Wilson effect. Then we called it the Joe Arpaio effect. And now I think people are calling it the Trump effect, because of the perception of intolerance in the primary season towards them. To use it to speed up the process of registration and voting, we're launching a campaign called F the Wall. That stands for Fight the Wall, Register a Mexican to Vote. We're launching a smartphone app called Latino Vote, Your Vote is Your Voice, where people can simply download the app onto their smartphone and register to vote online in 31 states.
Can you register on the app in Texas?
You can fill out the form, then you have to print it and send it in. Texas does not yet have online registration. That's something we'll be introducing once again in 2017.
I think most people know that when you're talking about the wall, you're talking about Donald Trump's proclamation that if he's elected, he'll build a wall between Mexico and the United States, and he'll make Mexico pay for it. That has been, in your mind, particularly annoying, upsetting to Latinos.
Well, yes, but it's not just Donald Trump. He's just the most vociferous. All of the other Republican candidates were for it, and the Democrats voted for a bill that funded completion of the border wall. So that's why we're calling our campaign Fight the Wall. Both parties bear some guilt. And typically in legislation, you take the last piece of legislation that didn't make it, and that's where you start. So we're very concerned that the new immigration reform bill that'll be introduced in 2017 will have the full border wall with $40 billion in it. Mr. Trump, in effect, has done us a favor. I like to say a good villain is a terrible thing to waste. He's created a boogeyman for us. We know from our experiences in California and Arizona that boogeymen are effective in inspiring new participation from Latinos. The Latino vote is on a mobilization trend. It's the fastest growing registration and voting group in America.
There's been a lot of talk, and I know you know this, about our former mayor from San Antonio, Julian Castro, being a vice presidential pick for Hillary Clinton. If that were to happen, or if another Latino became part of one of the presidential tickets, would that spur turnout in your mind?
Absolutely. I think HUD Secretary Castro would be an excellent choice. And there are others that are in the running as well. You'd have to talk about Congressman Becerra from Los Angeles. His name is also out there. And the Labor Secretary is also out there. That would stimulate more Latino voting. Identity, really, next to party, is the most important indicator of political participation.
If it comes to pass that there is no Latino on a presidential ticket, you think there'll be a great deal of disappointment? Do you feel like there's an anticipation out there for someone who would be a role model for the Hispanic community?
I think it will certainly be helpful, and it would be worth, you know, probably one or two national points, meaning we project about an 82% rate of turnout. If Castro was on the ticket for Latinos, maybe it would be up to 84. But this is going to be a high turnout race. The issues are important. They're intensive. And Latinos always have a high rate of increase in registration and a high rate of turnout in open presidential seasons. Latinos like competition. To them, it means their vote counts more. So we are very confident that there will be, nationally speaking, a high rate of Latino registration and turnout. And for us, the question is, how can we push it higher?
Thank you so much, Antonio Gonzalez.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
That was Antonio Gonzalez, president of the Southwest Voter Registration Project, which is launching a new app, Fight the Wall. Now a look at how some American eye doctors are crossing borders to help people with cataracts see again. Cataracts, the clouding of eye lenses, are the leading cause of curable blindness worldwide. They're incredibly treatable, but for people who have lost their ability to see clearly, not being able to get the surgery can mean a life with no livelihood. KERA's Christopher Connolly recently spent a day with North Texas doctors learning to help people with cataracts in the poorest parts of the world. And in those countries, they're doing the surgeries without the help of machines.
Go in under and inside.
Okay. In a learning laboratory on the sprawling campus of eye care company Alcon in Fort Worth, a handful of doctors are learning to remove cataracts manually. It's a technique that's not particularly common in the U.S. these days.
You are lucky there's no blood here.
Right? But somehow it makes it a little bit...
No, you go to the, through up to the limbus.
Okay. Elena Ndume is teaching Jennifer Deakins in a bright room filled with state-of-the-art equipment. They're looking through a huge microscope at a pig's eye that's tacked to a piece of styrofoam formed in the shape of a human face. Ndume is here from Namibia, and the small incision cataract surgery method she's teaching is kind of her stock in trade. It requires a tiny cut made by hand to get at the lens that's gone bad. And it isn't always easy.
Don't go deep.
Okay, go full up.
Yeah, full up. And also don't go full up because otherwise you perforate and things are going to be difficult for you.
Okay. And Ndume has performed more than 30,000 cataract surgeries in her country on the southwest coast of Africa. Cataracts are incredibly common, especially in older folks, and they're super fixable, but you need eye surgeons to treat them. And in many developing nations like Namibia, Ndume says medical needs often outweigh capacity.
There are so many other diseases which has to be tackled too, like HIV and AIDS is a problem. And then you have also this modern life disease that is spreading like wildfire in our country, like things like diabetes and hypertension.
So in a lot of places, foreign doctors, including some from Texas, volunteer a week or two to help perform surgeries. Dr. Ndume operates eye camps in remote parts of Namibia. She says Western doctors, folks like the one she's training by cutting pig's eyes, need to know how to operate outside of the high-tech surgical theaters they're used to.
When I'm in Windhoek in the capital city, I'm like here, the theater, everything. But when I go to the eye camp, it's a different ballgame altogether.
Most doctors, 95% of the operations they've done are with the machines. They're dependent on those machines.
Daniel Gold is an ophthalmologist based in Palestine, Texas, who's done medical missions all over the world.
I've been many times in the Middle East. I've been in Africa. I've been in China. Went one time to Fiji.
Gold says in private practice in the U.S., most cataracts are treated early with expensive machines that break up the bad lens to replace it with an artificial one. He says the manual incision process means getting back to basics, basics that are rarely taught in med schools in the West.
The manual small incision, we've been able to now perfect it where it can be done without stitches, but there are cases where you have to put in stitches, and many of the doctors haven't done much suturing.
Randall Avolio says cataract surgeries are simple, but their impact is huge. Avolio runs See International, a California nonprofit that plays matchmaker for eye doctors who want to go on medical missions. The group also supports doctors in developing countries, doctors like Helena Ndume, by helping them get surgical equipment and eye care supplies from companies like Alcon. Losing vision means lower life expectancy for the blind person, he says. And it also impacts the whole family.
When an individual is blind, often a child is taken out of school and they tend to the adult who needs the help.
Avolio says 80% of curable blindness is caused by cataracts worldwide. Millions of people are dying early because of something treatable. So a cataract surgery is literally life-changing, he says. And the beauty of it, it's also pretty easy and pretty cheap, about 20 minutes and $100 per patient on average.
I don't know many other things that for so few dollars delivers so much result.
The challenge is getting enough surgeons who know how to do the right kind of surgery to the patients who need them. One promising sign, Avolio says, See International has a waiting list for the trainings for doctors who want to help. For Fronteras, I'm Christopher Connolly.
Coming up on Fronteras, how would you manage if you couldn't read? Well, millions of Americans struggle with that every day.
We do get lost. And it's like, where are the bathrooms? How do you get to point A to point B?
We'll find out how people are conquering illiteracy and an effort to prevent child abuse in New Mexico. After this. I'm Shelley Koffler, and this is Fronteras. We go now to New Mexico for a look at efforts to tackle two social problems, child abuse and illiteracy. Child abuse and neglect is highly preventable. That's according to a report recently released by the Centers for Disease Control. It says ending child abuse should be a public health priority. Marissa DeMarco of public radio station KUNM teamed up with KNME New Mexico PBS. They looked at prevention efforts like the Nurse Family Partnership Program in Albuquerque.
Every few months or so, a shocking case of child abuse or neglect hits the news. And it's true that the rates of child maltreatment in the state have been climbing pretty steadily since at least 2005. But research is showing that states can curb not just child abuse numbers, but health and education problems for kids by partnering nurses with vulnerable families early.
Look, see? You're funny.
16-month-old Donnie is closing in on my microphone. Donnie tries to eat it.
He's trying to lick it.
Donnie's an active, curious toddler with curly hair and a ready smile. Just after he was first born, though, his parents noticed something was off. When Dad squeezed the baby's fingertips slightly, the nails didn't quickly return to their normal white. Tests showed that the newborn had a congenital heart defect.
And it was not until the doctor told us how serious it was that it really set in. This isn't repairable unless we do surgery. Like, he's not going to grow out of it. It needed to be done, like, now.
It was,
and,
like, 10 minutes to get ready for heart surgery.
Donnie's mom, Lana Brooks, says she's grateful to the registered nurse who'd been visiting her during her pregnancy and who helped her advocate for her newborn when they first spotted signs of his heart issue. They're participating in the Nurse Family Partnership Program, which supports first-time mothers during pregnancy and then provides education on child development and nutrition once the baby arrives. And it's helpful to all family members, including dads like Gregory Perea, who are working through rough family histories that include gangs, drugs, and incarceration.
I'm going to show him a whole different life. He ain't going to see daddy the way daddy was, but I'm going to show him to make better decisions.
And I think, you know, most parents want or hope that their kids are going to grow up and have success and be happy people, right? But do you feel like you have more tools now to, like, make that happen?
Most definitely. Because I'm not parenting the way my parents did it or the way his parents did it. I'm sure they did the best they could with what they were given, but it wasn't what I want for Donnie.
And it was hard for these parents to agree to participate in the nurse program, to allow someone to enter their house and to feel like those visits weren't going to be judgmental. Louise Kahn, the nurse who works with Lana and Gregory, says building trust is among the most important work she does.
Many families are really reticent to let people into their lives that way.
Kahn says some of that reluctance comes from the residual trauma that lingers after past bad experiences with child services. KUNM reached out to the state's Children, Youth, and Families Department, which declined to provide someone for an interview.
We're only serving 3% of eligible families across the state. Part of that is because of funding, but part of it is also about engaging families.
That all starts before the baby is born, when these nurses first reach out to expectant moms.
Pregnancy is a window of hope and excitement and opportunity for the mother and the father.
Plus, Kahn adds, if you look at it economically, studies have shown that working with pregnant women increases the bang for your preventive buck. Dr. Javier Aceves is a pediatrician who works with the New Mexico Child Abuse Prevention Partnership. He says we should not accept child maltreatment as the norm in New Mexico, and punishment for poor parenting doesn't address the complexity of the issue overall.
I think many times the punitive approach is chosen as a quick solution, but also very judgmental and very short-sighted. We're only seeing the manifestation of a problem. You're not seeing the problem.
Problems like long-term high stress levels in families that are struggling financially and don't have everything they need for their kids. Aceves says where New Mexico has fallen short is in knitting together a network of all the services that aim to support families and stop child maltreatment.
There's much greater opportunity to change things dramatically, meaningfully, if you put your money and your efforts into prevention.
There are many places around the state where this work in prevention is happening, he says, but agencies need to combine their efforts to have a greater collective impact. Reporting from Albuquerque, I'm Marisa DeMarco.
Now the other issue we mentioned, illiteracy. Imagine when you walk out of your house, the road signs are blank. Billboards are printed with gibberish. When you order breakfast at a new restaurant, you have to listen carefully to other customers to figure out what's on the menu. KUNM's Anna Lande reports that's the reality for thousands of New Mexico adults and 32 million Americans who are struggling to read.
Peter Aragon is a radio DJ. He didn't know how to read well, and he says that created everyday puzzles.
We do get lost. And it's like, where are the bathrooms? How do you get to point A to point B? And you got to read the prescription. What medicine are you going to be taking? You're going to overdose on aspirin or Xanax?
People who study literacy rates estimated that 16% of adult New Mexicans needed literacy services. That was in 2002. Another analysis in the late 90s found that only a fraction of those people seek help.
I was ashamed when I started literacy. I was like, nah, I can't do this.
But Aragon found he actually could do this. He went with a friend to get tutoring at Santa Fe Literacy Volunteers in the 90s. He was reading at a third grade level and has been improving ever since. When he finished the book, Bless Me, Ultima.
I was like, yes! I saw the movie and they left a whole bunch of stuff out in the movie. But he said, well, they left that out and they left that out.
Folks who are functionally illiterate have gotten schooling. They just can't read well enough to get by in many everyday situations. As a result, they have limited job opportunities because most workplaces require more than basic reading skills.
I was thinking about it the other night and I said, I feel like I'm losing out on a lot of things because I don't read. I can't read what's happening, what's going on, so I miss out.
David Manzanares gets tutoring at Santa Fe Literacy Volunteers, too. He's got a green thumb and likes to ride his Harley. But after an accident, he had to relearn how to walk and read.
When I read my first book from start to finish, that's what really excited me the most.
Susan Rathgen is an instructor with the program, and she says lots of folks have initial feelings of shame and hesitation.
Some people try to hide the fact that they can't read, and they're embarrassed about it.
Because of the stigma associated with illiteracy, she's struggling to recruit students from the community. But people like Tina Redondo have managed to take that first step. She started about 2 weeks ago.
In my whole life, I've struggled with ADHD and also epilepsy.
Redondo says she found the courage to get tutoring because she wants to be a role model for her daughters.
A lot of people are ashamed of to come out. You can change that and come over here, even for 1 hour, and make difference for your future and your children.
Rathjen says as an instructor, she just wants to share that love for books with her students, even though she knows it takes a while.
I don't mean to sound corny, but I really do see it. When students come in and they're kind of look beaten down or just so troubled and sad, and some little simple step that they make with the tutor can make all the difference.
And these students say their lives are improving. What would they tell folks who are afraid to get help?
People give up and give up and give up. And that's why I say don't give up. You can do it.
You're not alone. You just got to take that one step.
It takes a lot of time. It took me a lot of time.
Now they're reading maps, newspaper headlines, and websites. They're navigating a new world. Reporting from Santa Fe, I'm Anna Landy.
And that's it for Fronteras and this week's stories from the Southwest. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Taronga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Shelley Koffler at Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.